Hello there. Did you miss me? Well, you know what happened. I became a father for the first time, and I had to take some time off to figure some things out. You might or can imagine what all of this might have been. But now I'm back, and I'm so happy that you're still around, and this episode's gonna be great. Stick around, because in this episode, we will go on a bigger level and find out how did the bloody Battle of Vorringen, and I'm not cursing, it was really bloody in comparison to other medieval battles. So, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the history of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old, but up until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past tense. It can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. In the last episode, I know it's been a few months, but, well, that's what happens when you get a baby. We met Archbishop Siegfried of Westerburg, who became Archbishop of Cologne in 1275. 13 years later, in 1288, he would find himself on the battlefield at Vorringen, north of Cologne, and he would be a participant in one of the largest battles of the German Middle Ages. Around 10,000 people clashed on that day and slaughtered each other. You know, I am not a big fan of wars, not in the past and not recently as well, and find it strange to describe battles as great or epic. Nevertheless, in the next few episodes, we will circle around this battle like a moth around a light bulb at night, because although war is still shit bad, it is nevertheless very well documented in historical sources. And it shows us things that are interesting beyond the actual military course of the battle, for example, fashion. So, stick around. But today I want to do something different. The Battle of Vorringen is still a topic, yes, but since the German throne dispute around 1200, I have actually avoided placing the city of Cologne in its overall historical context every time in this podcast for well-known reasons. I was afraid that it would be far too complicated for a podcast format like mine, which is silly because I peddle the credo that Cologne's city history is a microcosm of European history in this podcast. Cologne is not an island in the deep, wide sea, but has always been embedded in the regional and larger spheres of influence of its time, be it the Roman Empire, the East Frankish Empire, or now the Holy Roman Empire that emerged from it. And things, let's be honest, were not going well for this Holy Roman Empire at the time. So it's great that you are back with me again. In the last episode, as I said, we took a close look at Siegfried von Westerburg, the power-hungry and technically brilliant Archbishop of Cologne. Please bear in mind that unlike today, these bishops were often younger sons of the high nobility who held these offices in the hope of also being able to shine politically while their oldest brother gets all the family heritage. We saw how Siegfried saved his career with a daring ride to Lyon in France after he had initially failed miserably in the election for Cologne's archbishopric within the cathedral chapter. But today, I want to take a step back with you. Let's look at the empire level again. We will look not only at the Rhineland, but at the entire German Empire in this absolutely crazy time before, during, and after the Battle of Vorringen. For it is here that the regional rulers in the northwest of the empire are fighting each other. Hence the question that one might rightly ask, where was the central power, the emperor, who, as guardian of peace in the empire, should have prevented this bloody battle? The question of whether an emperor could have prevented this conflict is, of course, another complicated question that is not so easy to answer, but let's assume that an emperor could have prevented it. Then we have to conclude that there was simply no emperor, not just for a week, not just for a year, but for years and decades. Imagine, Emperor Frederick II dies, and suddenly, nothing is as it was before. An entire system that had proven itself collapses. It is, as people would later say, an emperorless period, beginning in 1250, or to use the beautiful Latin-sounding word, as interregnum. It was to last until 1273, but its effects sent shockwaves far beyond that time, even beyond the Battle of Waringen in 1288. So, who was in charge of the empire at that time? Quite a few people set out to lead the empire from then on it, after 1250, after Frederick II died. After all, there were elections for a king, but none of the elected kings, and there were several of them, was able to assert himself throughout the empire. We will look at all of this today in connection with the development of Cologne at that time, after the intro. We need to talk about the year 1250. December 13th, 1250, is the day Emperor Frederick II died, and it's fair to say that with the death of the Staufer ruler, an entire era came to an end. Historians often consider this to be the beginning of the late Middle Ages in Germany, so the High Middle Ages end with Frederick II and the late Middle Ages begin after that. Of course, one can argue about such boundaries, that is the first thing one learns when studying history, that they are nonsense, but they are good reasons, arguments for a real turning point here in German history. Frederick II was the last Staufer who truly embodied the empire as a whole and as its complete ruler, especially in the categories of being holy and Roman in the eyes of his contemporaries. And don't come with that quote from that French guy from the 18th century. What came after that? The so-called interregnum, a time without an emperor. The whole thing was a real tragedy for the last male Staufers. Frederick's only legitimate son, Conrad IV, was elected king in 1237 already, but after the loss of the imperial city of Boppard in 1251, he had virtually no power left in the north of the empire, north of the Alps, so to speak, so of three quarters of his empire. He fled to southern Italy to save the Staufer inheritance there, but died in 1254, only 4 years after his father. And then things get really grim. We have Manfred, the illegitimate son, who struggles to survive in Sicily until he loses to Charles of Anjou in 1266, a man whom the Pope himself had deployed against the Staufers in Sicily. And then the sad climax, the very last male Staufer, Conradin, the last real hope for the Staufer party. In 1268, having just come out of age, he attempts to reconquer southern Italy and ends up where? On the scaffold in Naples, being beheaded. 1268, that is the end of the Staufers. A head rolls and a dynasty dies out. Madness, isn't it? What would Cologne be without this dynasty of the Staufers? No expansion of the city limits, and above all, no relics of the three kings in the city, the three magi, I think you say in English. But what does that mean for the empire? When the great family is gone, who takes over? Something fundamental happens here. Power shifts, away from son succession to permanent royal election at the top of the empire. In France, however, the exact opposite happened. In the past, the nobles, the magnates of the empire, had little choice but to elect the king's son because the authority of the incumbent ruler was so strong. This was the case in 10th century under the Ottonians and well into the 13th century under the Staufers. But now, already in the 12th century, the idea grew more and more among the nobles, the magnates of the empire, hey, we want to have a say as well. The Staufers had tried to style themselves, though, as the seamless continuation of the previous Salian dynasty, almost a religious ideology that their empire would last until the end of the world, until Judgment Day. But the Pope clearly torpedoed that. He wanted to brand the Staufers as persecutors of the Church in order to strengthen the magnates' rights to vote in the empire, with really long-term success, as we see. And now, we come to the period known as the Interregnum, the time without an emperor, the period from 1250 onwards. But do you know what's exciting about it? The term was deliberately invented at that time already by Staufer supporters to say anyone who is not a Staufer is not a real king. For there were already men who were preparing to rule during this rulerless empire, emperorless period, just not Staufers, because they had died out. And who played the leading role in this chaos? Among others, the powerful Archbishops of Cologne, of course. Konrad von Hochstaden, already well known to us here in the podcast, was a true champion of the election of kings by the highest nobles of the empire. It was he who, in 1246, merely responded to the Pope's call to elect an anti-king to oppose the still reigning Frederick II. First, Heinrich Raspe, and when he died, Konrad himself ensured the election of William of Holland in 1247 at a meeting in Worringen. Yes, exactly here, Worringen. What irony. Remember this. Decades before that great battle, Worringen was, among other things, a place for important political decisions. The Interregnum was a crazy time. It sometimes reminded me of the infamous Four Emperors period in Roman history. And in 1257, there was even a double election, so half of a Four Emperors year. The princes, the nobles, the magnates of the empire could not agree and elected two foreign rulers as king. Richard of Cornwall, you might guess where he's from, and Alfonso X of Castile, so an Englishman and a Spaniard, respectively. Richard was the brother of the English king. Alfonso was a Spaniard with a Stauffermother. The problem, they hardly ever showed up in Germany. They were never able to exercise their power here. Alfonso never even came. He remained in Spain. Imagine that you have a king who is hundreds of kilometers away. Those who still remember now and know that in those days it was essential for a ruler to travel around his own empire as much as possible in order to exercise real power. There was no other way in pre-modern times because there was no bureaucracy or institutions like today with tens of thousands of civil servants doing your bidding. This is when the local princes, including those in the Rhineland, Cologne, Jülich, Berg, Brabant, began to do their own thing. They sensed an opportunity for their political ambitions due to the power vacuum in the empire at the top. The Interregnum ended several years before this bloody battle in Worringen in 1288, but the effects could no longer be completely reversed. In 1273, Rudolf of Habsburg brought some order back after almost a quarter of a century. This officially ended the Interregnum in historical science stuff. But even the first Habsburg on the throne did not have an easy time of it. The princes had elected him because they thought, he's not too powerful, we can control him. But Rudolf was clever. He wanted to make an empire that was an hereditary empire for his family. And who stood in this way once again? That's right, the Archbishop of Cologne, in particular Siegfried von Westerburg, steadfastly refused to elect Rudolf's son as his successor in 1287 and again in 1290. That is why Rudolf von Habsburg was never crowned emperor. He simply could not go to Rome because his succession at home wasn't even secure. And after Rudolf, that was when Siegfried von Westerburg's moment as a true kingmaker arrived. In 1292, he pushed his own brother-in-law, Adolf von Nassau, onto the throne. He was the head of a coalition against the Habsburgs, who were really people, not yet as even slightly powerful as we know them from history well into the 20th century, being the leaders of Austria and later the Austrian-Hungarian Empire in the 19th century. That is still far, far away. But Adolf von Nassau was ultimately unlucky. Although this all happened after the Battle of Worringen, it shows how weak the central power, so the office of the king, had become. Adolf von Nassau quarreled with the Archbishop of Mainz because he tried to seize territories in Meissen and Thuringia. And the end result? The electors declared him unfit and useless and deposed him in 1298. And people, this was really a first. Adolf von Nassau was the first deposed ruler of the empire who was not declared mentally incompetent or too old or something like that. No, they just called him incompetent. That would have not been possible under rulers like the Etonians, where it was said that an elected king was chosen by God. So, yeah, Adolf von Nassau was healthy, but considered incompetent, and that's the reason why they deposed him. This was followed by a bloody battle at Göllheim in the same year, 1298, in which Adolf lost to Albrecht of Habsburg and lost his life. As you can see, in the period immediately before, during and after the Battle of Vorringen, the throne was a hot seat. No king succeeded in having his son succeed him immediately until well into the 14th century, and nobody even managed to become emperor, being crowned by the Pope in Rome. This would only change in 1356, finally being settled by the Golden Bull, a great, great late medieval document, but we're not there yet, we will not talk about it. Now you may be asking yourselves, all well and good, these kings and popes, but what did the empire actually look like? Who lived there? If you had asked someone back then what Teutonia or Germania, so Germany, was, he or she would have said, it's the land on the North Sea that stretches down south to the Alps. A Dominican monk described it at the time as stretching from Utrecht in today's Netherlands or Lübeck in the north of Germany to the Alps in the south. That was a distance that a person could cover on foot in about 4 weeks. And from Freiburg in the west to Vienna in the east. Both cities are in the south, Vienna today being part of Austria. That was Germany for the people at that time. As always, however, one must be cautious here. It is a purely geographical term, Germany. The idea of a nation-state or of being a single people did not emerge here until the 19th century after Napoleon. And flowing through the middle of this country were great rivers, foremost among them the Rhine, the lifeline of Cologne, then as now. But cities such as Basel, Strasbourg, Koblenz, Mainz and Neuss also lay on its banks. But how many people lived there actually in medieval Germany? Around 1300, Europe had a population around 60 to 70 million. In the territory of present-day Germany alone, the population grew from 8 million in 1200 to a whopping 14 million in 1300. Imagine that, only in 100 years, nearly doubled. That is a tremendous increase of population that we would not see again until the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century. But compared to today, the cities in Europe were tiny. With 80,000 inhabitants, Paris was the absolute megacity in Western Europe. But do you know which city was number one in what is now Germany? As listeners to this podcast, you already know the answer, of course. Cologne. With almost 40,000 inhabitants, today this would be considered a small city. There are city quarters in Cologne that they are larger than that. Cologne was still the largest city in what is now the German-speaking world. By comparison, Frankfurt and Augsburg didn't even have 10,000 inhabitants at that time, and Nuremberg, who would surpass Cologne at the end of the late Middle Ages, was not even close to it. Cologne was therefore a real heavyweight, a metropolis that didn't have to hide from Flemish cities such as Ghent and Bourges, which were major economic centers at the time as well, in close proximity. Cologne's size also explains why the city was so confident in the 13th century when dealing with its archbishops. The city had money, privileges, a solid city wall, the largest medieval city wall at that time, many relics of saints that brought a lot of pilgrims to its shores, and above all, a large number of people that was a power tool as well. Assuming that half of them were male, Cologne could theoretically provide several thousand men, at least for local defense. Considering that medieval armies often consisted of only a few thousand men, 1, 2, 3, or 4 thousand, Cologne was a major player at that time. As mentioned, this was only regionally and primarily in the defensive capacity, but you might remember Vorringen is in the region of Cologne. How often had foreign rulers and even the city's own archbishops attempted to conquer the city militarily? They had all failed miserably because of those facts I just listed. But as important as cities like Cologne were, the empire, like the rest of Europe north of the Alps, was mainly rural. 90% of the population lived in the countryside, in small hamlets and villages. But even there, enormous change could be observed in the late Middle Ages. The entire society there was in a state of upheaval. This is most clearly seen in the most important economic sector, agriculture. Since the 11th century, there had been a significant upswing, which we have mentioned here from time to time. New cultivation techniques, such as three-field crop rotation, led to more grain and higher prices. In addition, there were improvements in technology and equipment for farmers and, above all, the emancipation of farmers in general. This fundamentally changed the lives of farmers. In the early Middle Ages, in particular, there was the so-called Fronhof system. I tried to find a translation for English. It's something like manorial system. Let me try to explain it to you. Imagine it like this. The landlord had his farm, and the farmers were essentially his serfs, who had to work there for several days or even weeks a year for free. The lord owed them nothing, and at the same time, I mean, besides protection, but he didn't give them money for that. And at the same time, the farmers could not work on their own fields on those many days. They had to work at their lord's fields. But in the 13th century, this system was fundamentally dissolved. The nobles retreated to their fancy castles and were no longer directly present with the farmers in the villages. The farmers became so, in this way, more independent. And when the landlord is no longer on site and hiding in a faraway castle, you can no longer go to him and work for him. Instead of hard labor and being away from their own fields, serfs now pay taxes, most of the time now in money, to the landlords. These could be negotiated, especially if the farmers got together locally. Suddenly, not only in the cities, but also in the countryside, there was something like a political community with the first signs of self-government and emancipation. And then there is the knighthood. That is the image we all have in our minds about knights, shining armor, honor, battle. But the reality was much more complex. In the High Middle Ages, knight was actually any warrior, whether noble or not. Even Frederick Barbarossa proudly called himself a knight, being the emperor. But particularly important were the ministerials, whom we often encountered in Cologne and who became the wealthy and powerful class of patricians alongside the long-distance merchants. Ministerials, as a little refresher, were originally serfs, servants of the king or, in the case of Cologne, of the archbishop. But they quickly rose through their social ranks. They became administrators and warriors and emancipated themselves from their original lords. Remember Gerhard Umbartz of Cologne from the 12th century. He deliberately made himself a serf ministerial from a free citizen, but in doing so became so rich as the archbishop's administrator and custom officer that he ended up being the archbishop's major creditor and had his own magnificent mansion right next door to the archbishop's palace at the cathedral, roughly where the Heinzelmännchenbrunnen fountain is today. In cities such as Cologne, these ministerials, together with the wealthiest long-distance merchants, formed the patricians, the ruling class of the citizens. Although they initially accepted new members, this practice had virtually disappeared by the end of the 13th century. The group closed itself off not only from the archbishop, but also from the ordinary inhabitants of Cologne. They now defended their hard-won status against potential newcomers. Something similar happened in the countryside with the ministerials. There, the once unfree ministerials rose to the lower nobility and becoming knights. Here, too, the motto was isolation. They wanted to remain among themselves, and woe betide anyone who threatened that, whether from below or above in terms of power. When we take all this together, we see an empire that completely reinvented and rebalanced itself internally in terms of its composition, but also at the top. The old system in which the emperor reigned supreme as the supreme lord of peace, as Frederick II had still dreamed of in 1235 in the Mainz Imperial Peace, had broken down. Frederick II wanted an empire in which every prince under him was merely an executive arm of him, the emperor. Anyone who levied custom duties or minted coins without his permission was to be punished like a street robber. This was a level of power that kings would not usually have until the age of absolutism in the 18th century, if at all. But after 1250, after the death of Frederick II, who had dreamed of all this, well, such a strong position for the king was no longer conceivable. King Rudolf of Habsburg had to work with the princes, whether he liked it or not. Without the princes, the Habsburgs would never have received the crown. The princes were now permanent partners in power, and power did not implode in the empire, as it was often said about the Holy Roman Empire, but was simply distributed among more shoulders. The princes expanded their own territories, often using harsh methods. Regional rulers built castles, such as the Count of Jülich in the last episode at Worringen, in order to consolidate and secure their own lands piece by piece. This was the new reality throughout the empire, fragmented power politics of regional rulers instead of imperial splendor at the top. And it is precisely in this area of tension that Worringen and the battle that took place here in 1288 belong. As we will examine in more detail in a future episode, it was not just a dispute over castle or customs duties, it was the clash of all these new forces, a powerful city like Cologne that wanted its freedom, an archbishop like Siegfried who wanted to exploit the power vacuum, and new players who now saw their hour had come, the local princes who in turn wanted to build their own close territories. This development had already taken place before, yes. Archbishop Anno II had also fought against the Etzonids in the 11th century already, but now it was on a completely different scale, engulfing the entire northwestern corner of the empire. This period of interregnum and the period at the end of the 13th century had a bad reputation for a long time in historical science. In the 19th century, for example, the period in which German historical science emerged and has had a decisive influence on it to this day, this period was often seen as a decline because people wanted a strong empire. In their own time, speaking of the 19th century, when Germany was still fragmented after Napoleon's defeat, an empire that would then be created in 1871. Today, the picture is more nuanced and, above all, more forgiving of these developments in the late Middle Ages. It wasn't a decline, it was a process of transformation, a diversity of new forces in the form of cities and regional rulers. That's the late Middle Ages in Germany. Broader participation. Some saw this as the typically German path to federalism, which we have today, which continues to shape this country. You have to decide for yourselves how you see that theory. So, a lot happened between 1250 and 1300. From the death of the last great Staufer ruler Frederick II to several unsuccessful kings to the distribution of power among regional players and cities. All reasons, or rather background factors, that made such a bloody battle in the north of Cologne possible. I hope this brief overview has helped you to better understand the period during the Battle of Worringen that is about to come. Thanks to Christian, Karin, Claudia, Silvia, Tanja, Dominik, Michael, Jürgen, Hans, Beatrix, Ingrid, Norbert, Kerstin, Antje, Lisa, Christian, Andreas, Felix, Per, Jonas, Jürgen, Silvia, Marlies, Eckhardt, Erik, Beatrix, Simon, Thomas, Antje, Andreas, Christian, Norbert, Andreas, Silvia, Yannick, Beatrix, Michael, Antje, Christian, Nils, Silvia, Stephanie and Doris for your donations via PayPal. This time I used the chapter The German Empire at the Time of the Battle of Worringen by Odilo Engels in the book Im Namen der Freiheit 1288 bis 1988, so The Name of Freedom 1288 to 1988, which was published as an anthology on the occasion of the 700th anniversary. Thank you for tuning in again, and we will get more into detail of the Battle of Worringen next time. So, auf Wiedersehen.